Please, speak as you might to a young child or a golden retriever.
It's an unfair game.
They're schemers. Schemers trying to control their little worlds.
Rich get richer, that's the law of the land.
It's just money.
Blasphemy! This is madness!
I drink your milkshake!
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Milkshakes, Markets, Madness. Now, if you're wondering what the heck the purpose of the word milkshakes is in our name, then you probably have never heard of the dollar milkshake theory, which my friend here, Brent Johnson, came up with to kind of break down and describe the US dollar's role in the monetary system and overall how the monetary system works using the dollar kind of as the centerpiece. This is an important story or narrative so that you can better understand how to approach the markets with all the hype and hyperbole around the end of the world, or at least the end of the dollar hegemony. So if you're unfamiliar with that, I encourage you to check out milkshakespod.com. There's a little more information there. Or visit our YouTube channel. At the top, we've got a playlist called Start Here. It has a presentation Brent did way back in the day when he first came up with the idea, and then a number of short clips to kind of reinforce some of those themes. So here we do weekly episodes covering markets. Once a week, we do a Madness Edition episode, which goes a little bit off the rails. This right now is our full-length recording where we're going to kind of look at markets overall the last week and kind of get a little deeper on maybe one or two big theme topics. And I think, Brent, to start off, one of the big themes here, it's always a big theme, but certainly recently has been China. Now, you know, I just described to everybody the fact that we have this busy schedule, videos that we release. One of the things we also do on Monday is a peek at the week. This upcoming week, there is some China data coming out. There's their unemployment rate and industrial production numbers. You know, one of the big jokes is that, you know, all of China's data is basically as opaque and worthless as it comes. But, you know, you had shared some thoughts on China overall, because this is still kind of coming off of this BRICS summit. There's a bit of residue from that. So do you want to share a little bit about, you know, one, you had provided this tweet that gave some context as to where China really is economically, but do you want to kind of bring China into the fold in terms of where things are right now economically overall?
Yeah, well, so China is, it's the proverbial, you know, bull in a china shop, sort of, right? Or the elephant in the room. You just can't ignore it. They're so important to the global economy. And so if they're doing great, that has huge influence. If they're struggling, that has a huge influence. And a big reason why markets have been relatively calm and upward sloping this year was the China reopening story. Right? They were going to, you know, stimulate their markets. They were fully reopening from COVID. This was going to be a tailwind to markets. And as such, asset prices would go higher. They didn't reopen as quickly as people thought. When they did reopen, their numbers didn't look as good as people thought. And, you know, since, let's call it the last 6 to 8 weeks, since the whole China reopening story has kind of hit a snag and the China stimulus story has not really come to fruition, markets have stopped going higher and have kind of leveled off, and we've started to see higher volatility. And I think China is a big part of it. Part of the reason is that China has a huge problem in their real estate market. They've been dealing with this for a couple of years. It's starting to hit critical stage now, and that's why, you know, they have had to, you know, while the U.S. has been raising rates, they've had to do ultra easy monetary policy. That is leading to the yuan falling dramatically versus the dollar. And that is making, that's on the one hand, it's helping to stimulate their exports. But on the other hand, it hurts the prices they have to pay for imports. They have to buy dollars to then buy the imports. As the dollar goes up, that's harder for them to do because they, you know, they use yuan or they use renminbi. So the other thing I would say with China is the real estate market. I think everybody realizes that in the world, there's a bunch of bad loans out there, right? Well, a lot of these bad loans are in the Chinese real estate market. And I think maybe it was 2 or 3 weeks ago, we talked about the Chinese real estate market being the biggest single asset class in the world, 60, 70 trillion or whatever the number is, right? And listen, I'm not going to sit here and pretend I know exactly how big the hole is in the Chinese real estate market, but I tend to believe it's bigger than the Chinese PBOC has filled. You know, earlier this year, we talked, when it came to the banking issues in the United States, we talked about there's a hole, and is the Fed or the Treasury or the, you know, the government, however you want to define the government entity that, that would, you know, provide relief or provide the bailout, have they done enough to fill the hole? I do not believe that the Chinese, you know, authorities have done enough to fill the hole. And I think the hole is bigger than many people realize. And even if I'm wrong and the hole is smaller and China does start to come out of this, I think that would be good for the overall global economy, not just good for the Chinese economy. And in that scenario, I would rather be invested in the U.S. than be invested in China. So I don't feel it's necessary. If you're trying to invest for growth or, you know, put your money where it's going to multiply, I think there's just as much upside being invested in the U.S. And I think there's a lot more downside being invested in China. And so I've kind of stayed away from allocating to China. And I think there's going to be some big problems in China. But I'm also the first one to say people have been talking about this for a long time. And I'm one of them that have been talking about it for a long time. And that's the deal with these big macro moves. You just never know how long they're going to take, but it doesn't mean they're not there. You know, Gave Cao, so Louis Vincent Gov is a very smart guy. He has a, you know, research company. And I think a couple weeks ago, he put out a report talking about, you know, if China's in so much trouble, then why aren't the numbers as bad as everybody says? And why have things not collapsed? And why this and why that? And listen, he makes a good point. If things are so bad, why haven't they collapsed? And the point is these, you know, these government entities, these central banks, these monetary authorities, they can keep the plates spinning for a long time. I guess I would flip it around and say, for all the people who say, well, China's fine because things haven't collapsed, then those same people that are saying that are also saying the U.S. is about ready to collapse. And I would say, well, if the U.S. is going to collapse, then why hasn't it? The point is that I think the whole world has problems. The whole world has immense issues. They have to deal with it. I don't think China's immune from that. And I think we're starting to see that China's running into the wall a little bit sooner than some of these other markets, and perhaps to a greater extent. You know, for the last couple of years, a lot of countries around the world raised rates. A lot of central banks had to tighten monetary policy to deal with inflationary pressures. China didn't. China, you know, has kept easy monetary policy, and they have easier monetary policy by a long shot today than the U.S. does. And it's because they're dealing with their problems while the U.S. has the ability to raise rates. And you're seeing that show up in the currency, and you're seeing that show up in the difference in asset prices. And so, you know, I think there's more to come for this. I don't think China's going to, you know, come out of this in a positive light, but we'll just have to wait and see when it actually triggers.
So we do a once a week featured clip. So we're kind of taking a clip from the previous week's full length episode. So for example, we share this recording right now on a Sunday. Tuesday is when most frequently we're going to share that clip. It's not going to come from this episode. It's going to come from the week before. So we had last week shared a clip about this conversation that we had around China. And it did get a lot of buzz and traction and a lot of different people chiming in on it. But, you know, within that, you know, there's this emphasis made that you just described. The thing I want to tack on to what you just said, which is so important, I mean, you pretty much articulated the whole idea, but just to go back and make sure people didn't miss it, one of the things that you're so frequently doing and a big core purpose with the dollar milkshake theory and why you have so much fun with it and pound the table on it is that people don't look at it from both sides. The point I'm making there is, well, if China, you know, doesn't deserve all the crap it's getting because, you know, it hasn't imploded yet, well, the same argument, the same narrative spin can be made for the US. More importantly, just because it hasn't happened yet doesn't mean it won't happen. And these things can take a really, really long time to play out, which is really the point. Like you've said specifically that, you know, a lot of the people that you might bump heads with in terms of how we get to this kind of endgame scenario doesn't change the fact that you both have similar beliefs as to what that endgame scenario potentially is or what it looks like. It's the path to get there is what, you know, where you differ. Most importantly, how long that path actually takes. So I want to kind of read more or less with what the tweet said that you had shared, because I want you to address specifically the currency response, or what China is doing with treasury holdings, and why this is not what, you know, this is not a, you know, running away from US dollar assets, but instead trying to defend their economy. So in your tweet, you said a lot has been made of China's US treasury holdings peaking a decade ago. You know what else peaked a decade ago? Their stock market, their currency, their natural birth rate, and with the exception of a post-COVID surge, their export growth rate. So all of those things are painting a pretty bleak picture, even if it takes longer than expected. But currently, right now, as far as what the PBOC and China in general is doing as far as selling treasuries, do you want to address what that behavior is actually telling us, especially based on some of the things you said in that tweet?
Yeah, so there's a couple things going on here. So first of all, we don't know for sure that China is selling treasuries. We think that they are selling some. But the idea that their purchases did peak 10 years ago. And the point I was making in that tweet was, yeah, and that's what everybody focuses on. And they focus on the fact that China is no longer buying treasuries, as if this somehow proves that China is in a better place than the United States, and that without China buying treasuries, this is going to be the end of the United States. So first of all, when they show this chart, they show the value of the Chinese treasuries coming down. And you'll see a big fall off over the last, call it, year or 2 years. It's like a 30% fall. It goes from, like, I don't know, 1.1 trillion to 800 billion or something like that. I'm just making up the number, but it's something like that. And they'll say, wow, China is really dumping treasuries. Well, they're not, because first of all, that is not a number of bonds chart. That is a dollar value of the bonds chart. And in the last 18 months, as the Fed has gone on one of its biggest interest rate tightening or monetary policy tightening moves in history, long-term bond prices have come down anywhere from 25 to 35%. It kind of depends on which holdings you are, but they have come down significantly. The value of them has. So that chart largely reflects the change in market value of those securities. It doesn't necessarily mean that they have dumped a bunch of bonds. The other thing is that even if they are selling some of those bonds, those are long-term treasuries. The amount of holdings that China owns from government agencies, not treasuries, but other government agency bonds, has been increasing over the last couple of years. So when you realize that those charts are showing the value, dollar value, not necessarily a number of bonds owed, and then you realize that they might just be switching from one form of government bond to an agency bond, the dumping isn't that big. The second thing that I would say is, just because they're selling bonds, that doesn't mean that means they're in a better position. You know, I've never seen a movie where the family is hawking the family silver that it makes it look like that family's in some great situation. Typically, when you're selling the family silver, you're in kind of a dire situation. You're doing it because you have to raise funds. So now, is that why China's doing it? Well, maybe or maybe not. But my point is that to operate on the global stage today, you still need dollars. I know some people don't like that, but that is the current reality. That may change someday. But today, you still need dollars. And for China to operate on the global stage today, they still need dollars. And the way that governments and central banks and big institutions store dollars is they buy U.S. treasuries. And then when they need them, they have them. Those are reserves. The other thing I would say, so that, you know, the fact that they are selling bonds to get cash shows, it doesn't necessarily show that they're in a good spot. It means that they need cash to operate. The other thing I would say is that, and this is where and I've talked about this before, and some people vehemently disagree with this, but I will stand by this, is that the U.S. has the ability to use the dollar and has the ability to use monetary policy as a weapon. Now, I don't know that they necessarily do that with its primary cause, but I do not think that they are blind to the fact that it's a secondary derivative of what they're doing for the domestic economy. So what I mean by that is, over the last couple of years, the U.S. has dramatically increased rates and dramatically tightened monetary policy. That has pushed the dollar higher and the rest of currencies around the world lower. And if we remember, did we just go back a year ago, countries around the world were in crisis as the dollar was at a 30-year high. We've talked about that in previous episodes too. I'm not going to go into all those details now. The U.S. isn't, I mean, again, the U.S. was raising rates for domestic purposes, but they know that it puts pressure and it puts other countries in a disadvantageous spot. And in a way, this is the U.S. saying, listen, you know, we know that this is, we know where we're at in the fourth turning. We know where we're at in the global cycle of things. We know there are problems coming. And we also know that we can sort of dictate when it comes and how it comes. We're not in total control, but we have more control than everybody else. And if China is going to be, you know, if they're going to challenge us on the global stage, well, then we have some, and they can use, you know, their BRICS summits and they can use their Bridge and Road initiatives. Well, we have some things that we can do too. And if you are going to start de-dollarizing, we will help you de-dollarize by making the value of your dollars fall. So if we take rates from 25 basis points to 5.5% over a period of 18 months, and your $1.2 trillion of treasury bonds becomes 800 billion U.S. treasury bonds, we've just devalued your dollars by 30%. So yeah, go ahead and sell them, but you are going to lose money on that transaction. Not only are you going to lose money, you're going to lose hundreds of billions of dollars on that transaction. I don't think that the U.S. Treasury and the Fed is blind to that fact. Now, again, I don't think that they're necessarily doing it as their primary cause, but I don't think they're blind to the fact that they can do that. So think about that. Over the last couple of years, the Fed, through their monetary policy, has caused other countries, some of them are allies, some of them not, to lose value of their saved dollars. The U.S. can create these dollars just at a snap of a finger. So they don't have this supply problem. The U.S. doesn't have the supply problem, but the rest of the world does, right? This is an event. Until there is a new system in place, this is an enormous, almost incalculable advantage to the United States. Now, will this end badly for everybody? Yes, this will end badly for everybody. But in the meantime, this is kind of one of the biggest weapons available. You kind of have to be very careful how you use it. But when you use it, is it extremely powerful? So I think the next time you see one of these China selling treasuries chart, or you hear somebody saying that if China sells our bonds, the United States is going to go bankrupt, you kind of got to step back and look at this from both points of view, because that is certainly not the only interpretation. And I would argue it's the wrong interpretation.
Who would have thought that the the advocates or those pounding the table about the BRICS and de-dollarization would be faced with an argument that says, yeah, they are de-dollarizing, but not at their own will, at the force of monetary policy in the U.S. The other thing that's kind of interesting about everything you just shared there, which again is just a big part of why we do these shows and a lot of what you're sharing in your comments and on Twitter, is that it feels oftentimes that people have a narrative that they cling to. Maybe it's based on moral premises, maybe they like the story. And so then once they've kind of fallen in love with whatever that global macro or domestic economy narrative is, they then go out and find pieces to support that story without actually understanding the pieces that they're plugging in into that narrative, instead of going out and looking at things and saying, why is this happening? And when something is being presented as, I mean, even if we knew what the data was, like you're saying, you know, some of this is not exactly how it appears. And we're all familiar with the abundance of chart crimes on places like Twitter. But even if the data was exactly the way it's being portrayed, the why behind it is often overlooked because people just want to plug it into their story.
That's exactly right. And, you know, again, all of this stuff that we talk about here, you know, we're giving our opinion and our interpretation. There is certainly no guarantee that we will be right, right? Just like there's no guarantee that other people will be right. And I'm not suggesting that people should just take my opinion or your opinion and treat it as sacrosanct. But what I would say is don't take anybody else's opinion as sacrosanct, right? Do your best to, you know, dig into this and really understand both sides. And this is a theme that we literally hammer in every episode, but it's important. The reason that we hammer it in every episode is it's probably the most important message that we can get across. And I just think the China story is a perfect way to display it. Yeah, China is a hugely important person or I'm sorry, entity on the global stage. You can't ignore them. They are going to, you know, for better or for worse, they are going to have a huge impact on where the world goes over the next, you know, 5, 10, 15, 25, 30, 50 years. Perhaps there will be a way that the U.S. and China can work peacefully together and we will see a lot of growth and harmony. It doesn't appear to me that in the short term that that's the where it's headed. And just because things are bad in the United States doesn't mean that they're not bad there. And just because things are bad there doesn't mean bad things can't happen here. But the point is there is not a scenario where China thrives and the U.S. ends up in a pile of ashes. You know, we can rise together, we can fall together, or we can have just a lot of conflict and, you know, perhaps one side does a little better than the other one. But it's not going to be a situation where, you know, China, you know, all of a sudden just continues their ascent and the United States, you know, falls off the top of the mountain and, you know, it's game over. This is going to be a long process. China has many problems that they don't want to advertise, just like the United States has many problems that they don't want to advertise. You got to do your best to kind of figure out, you know, what the truth is through all of those different articles you read or charts that you see. And kind of at the end of the day, you need to make up your own mind, but it's just important to kind of consider both sides of the argument.
Now, Brent, speaking of understanding the narrative, looking at charts and data from different perspectives, but also actually making sure that the data is accurate. You know, one of the things that's been kind of tossed around somewhat lightly lately is the idea of, you know, the rate hiking cycle and what this ultimately means for the bond market and why the bond market's under severe stress and how this is going to lead into some sort of huge banking crisis. So you just want to pick up the baton from there because it correlates very, very closely to everything you just explained in China, but it's more of a focus here domestically in the U.S.
Yeah, so if you look at, you know, this has gotten a ton of attention, you know, the bond we've had like a 30-year bond bull market, and, you know, and then in the last couple of years, you know, bonds have largely just gotten crushed, for lack of a better way of saying it, right? You know, the U.S. Treasury, whether it's the 10 or the 30, depending on where on the curve you are, but it's down anywhere from 25 to 35% over the last 18 months, and that's a huge drawdown. And so a lot of people have attributed that to the huge budget deficits and not only that, but we've got the twin deficits and we've had to have all these bailouts and we've printed all this money. And so, you know, this is just another argument that the U.S. is on death's door. And the point that I've pushed back on is, yeah, it's not great that Treasury prices have fallen if you are a Treasury bond holder. But this is not by accident. And the level of bonds falling, considering the level of interest rates that have been hiked, it is not unusual at all. And so I've had a couple of discussions where people are saying, oh, it's different this time. This is clearly, you know, the world is rejecting treasuries. Well, they're rejecting treasuries at 0.5%. Yeah, they want to get paid 5.5%. And as a result, bond prices have gone down. But again, this is nothing new. You know, I sent out a Twitter thread today. You know, gone back to the 1970s, the last time we had a very big, large rate hike cycle that this current one is being compared to was in the late 70s. And so from the late 70s until now, there's been 7 rate hiking cycles. The big one was in the 70s. There was a couple in the 80s, a couple in the 90s, and then, you know, one in the early 2000s, and then one now. If you go back and you actually look at what happened during those times periods, every time Treasury bonds fell precipitously. You know, there was a couple times where they fell 25 to 35%. That's exactly what's happened this time. And this time we've hiked rates faster than at any time before. Not only that, but I think the previous amount that we had hiked is, I've measured it a couple different ways. You have to go to the Twitter thread to see it. But, you know, the fact that rates went from 25 basis points to 5.5% in a year and a half, that's a 2,000% increase in interest rates from where they started. You know, it's 5.25% on an absolute level, but from a growth perspective, it's a 2,000% growth of interest rates in 18 months. Considering that, and just doing simple bond math, it's not shocking to see a long-term U.S. Treasury bond drop 30-35% under that scenario. Not only that, but this has literally happened every time before. Every other hiking cycle, you saw long-term bonds fall. Here's what was kind of interesting when I did the analysis too, is a lot of people say, well, as soon as interest rates start going up, you should sell bonds, or I mean, you got to sell stocks. Higher interest rates is bad for stocks. Well, the reality is the S&P 500 went up during every one of those hiking cycles. Now, it didn't go up a lot, and a lot of times it went up kind of at the end because people were anticipating lower rates, very similar to what's happened in this last time period. But the reality is if we look at all the six previous rate hiking cycles, over the period of rate hikes, the S&P actually was either flat or up in all of them. So far this time, the S&P is down 5%. Now, again, that was over the life cycle. There were periods in those previous life cycles or those rate hike cycles where equities were initially down and then rose in the end, which is kind of similar to what's happening again now. So this is very, very similar to what's happened in the past. There's no mystery here. It's very explainable. And so I'm not saying that it won't be different this time. I'm just saying so far it hasn't been. And so it's important when people tell you that this has never happened before and this is a sign that the world is never going to buy treasuries and this is a really bad sign for the U.S. Well, it's not a good sign for the U.S. But again, people said this every other time that this happened because this has happened pretty regularly. It hasn't, but you know, because interest rates were so high in the 70s and were so low a year and a half ago, there was basically a 40-year bond bull market, but there was a couple bear markets along the way inside that overall bull market. It's just that people who have now been working on Wall Street for 10 or 15 years have never seen it before, right? You know, there's not too many people still working on Wall Street that were here in the you know, late 70s or early 80s when we had these previous rate hiking cycles. And so, you know, this, again, it's important to understand how it could be different this time, but it's also very important to understand that it's not necessarily different this time. And so far, it's not different.
Yeah, look, if you're trying to time markets, you're almost guaranteed to lose. But if you're patient and you're positioned to kind of get washed around with the tide, I think eventually you find yourself in a position where you can get to shore and do well. And one of the things that you're discussing here as far as the absolute move, and it's definitely a painful thing for bond investors who've piled into bonds at all-time record lows and are now trying to deal with whether it's actual mark-to-market losses, or in the case of the banks, hold to maturity. What do we do if suddenly we need to actually liquidate these things to raise capital? And that exact concern led to the BTFP, the Bank Term Funding Program, where, you know, the Treasury and the Fed are providing liquidity to these banks. But, you know, the chances of this continually going higher as far as the bond market sell-off or interest rates on bonds going higher, irrespective of what the Fed does, it does seem like we're much more towards the end of this sell-off in the bond market. At the same time, when you have this type of monetary policy where they're raising interest rates, they're doing so aggressively, it's going to make, at least to some extent, investing in the U.S. economy and U.S. dollar-based assets attractive, especially in bonds and you know, short duration bonds, at least, because you're picking up 5%. But that tends to then make the dollar stronger for various reasons. You already mentioned in this conversation that U.S. government bonds, for a lot of entities and sovereign nations, the holding of government bonds is the same thing as holding dollars. It's their savings account. So now we're kind of looking at the narrative shifting slightly about the U.S. dollar. Like, it's on this kind of tear. It's at a rally. It's had a rally recently. You're now talking about where are we, or we're speculating where are we in this interest rate hiking cycle. We're talking about the pain that the bond market's feeling, which is then is impacting banks overall and the, you know, financial economy and financial industries overall. Do you feel like we are towards the end of this cycle because of all of these factors? Higher dollar, the Fed has been raising rates for a really long time, and the pain that's causing across multiple markets?
So I think we're towards the end, but I don't think we're at the end. I still expect them to hike rates this month. And it would not shock me if they hike again towards the end of the year. Again, I don't know for sure that they're going to, but I think we're closer to the end than we are to the beginning. But I'm not expecting, at least not currently, an imminent pivot by the Fed. Now, again, I've said this many times. If markets crater, or if some kind of black swan shows up, or if the system comes into jeopardy, they will of course absolutely pivot. But the point I want to make regarding, you know, being towards the end of the hiking cycle, or if we're at the end of the hiking cycle, and what has happened to bond prices, not only should it not be surprising, because the same thing has happened literally every other hiking cycle, but this is what the Fed wants to happen. This is the whole point of raising rates. They want to depress asset prices. The whole point of raising rates is to slow the economy, to slow down the growth of the economy, to depress asset prices in the hopes that then inflation will come down. One of the ways that you constrict growth is by, when you raise rates, it becomes harder to borrow. It doesn't necessarily become harder to borrow, but it becomes more expensive to borrow. Not only that, but when you raise rates, the collateral that the world has, which is real estate and treasury bonds, largely, or sovereign bonds, however you want to describe that, you figure real estate, sovereign bonds, and stock prices. Let's use those. When you raise rates, and borrowing becomes more expensive, it tends to put a lid, or at least some kind of a headwind, on real estate. When you raise rates, stocks tend to not grow as much because the economy's not expanding as fast. And bond prices fall because you are raising rates. Now, whatever you think of central bankers, whether you think them morons, whether you think them evil, whether you think them fools, I guarantee you that they know when you raise rates, bond prices fall. They do know that. And that's part of what they want to do, because treasuries are a huge source of collateral off of which new loans are made. If you devalue the price of treasuries, you are devaluing the amount of collateral out there, and therefore you are restricting the amount of new loans that can be pyramided on top of that collateral. So not only have treasury prices done this in every previous hiking cycle, this is what is supposed to happen, and this is why they do it. So consider that when you're looking at the price of bonds next time. Now, do they want yields to triple from here? Of course not, right? Do they want them to go so high the U.S. can't fund itself? Of course not. But so far, they have done exactly what they wanted to do. And as a result, and because they have been successful so far, and again, we've talked about this many times, I think ultimately they will not be successful, but so far they have been. And because they have so far been successful, I think they are getting close to the end of the hiking cycle. Do they get one more rate hike? Do they get two? Do they get three? I don't know. All I know is they've gotten about four or five more than a lot of people ever thought they would get in the first place. And so I think it's really important to understand that as we go forward. You know, it's it's hard to see them hiking significantly more from here. But, you know, I stopped saying never a long time ago. And I think the longer you're in this business, the less you use that word. And so I think it's kind of really important to understand that so far, everything that's happened has been exactly what they have wanted to do.
Something else to keep in mind, too, as we kind of wean off this topic is you have made the point, and you just did here, that, you know, as much as you might think the central bankers are idiots, there are some basic fundamentals that they do understand. For example, raising interest rates is going to cause bond prices to fall. The other thing it does is it makes the interest expense for businesses and governments increase if they have to refinance at those higher yields. So what'll be interesting to watch, I might have these numbers wrong, but I think in the next couple, let's say year and a half, it might've been 30 months. It might've been much less than that, but I think there's an absurd number of government debt that's going to be expiring and need to be refinanced. It could be something like $7 trillion. So if you're talking about debt that has been, you know, even a half of what interest rates are now needs to be refinanced, that puts a huge burden on the economy. So we'll see how the Fed tries to navigate through that obstacle, because not to say that they're going to cut interest rates so the government can fund itself, but they're certainly not going to keep raising interest rates up into the point where the government defaults. And it's, you know, one of the things you're talking about here in regards to bonds is the objective when you have 40-year high inflation is to slow the economy down. One of the ways to do that is certainly decrease asset values, especially those that are used for collateral. We'll wrap up here kind of on that idea. We do have a Monday peek at the week episode where we look at the economic data coming up for the week ahead. And we do have August CPI, the inflation data. So it'll be interesting to kind of see how that plays into not only this conversation, but maybe some of that forward guidance that the Fed likes to use. Brent, we appreciate everything that you shared with us this week. For everyone who's new to the show, maybe this is first time watching us, or if you've been with us for a long time, please take a minute to subscribe. We do appreciate that. And if you ever have any thoughts or comments, we're active both in the YouTube comments. And of course, Brent can't get enough of interacting with everybody on Twitter. So we appreciate everybody. This is Milkshakes Markets Madness. If you want to join Brent on Twitter, you can do that using his handle at SantiagoAUFund. My name is John Katsmita, and that is how you find me on Twitter at John Katsmita. And we are also having fun with the Milkshakes Pod Twitter account, which is found via Milkshakes Pod. That is also our website, milkshakespod.com. So those are all the fun ways to interact and connect with us. Thanks for joining us for this full-length episode, and we'll see you in about a day for the Monday peek at the week. This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.